Mr. O'Sullivan, reel 25. So, you're in the lager. You've had plenty of time to talk to each other, you know, over this period. What do you remember about all of your kind of post-war plans? What were you thinking you were going to do once you got out of this place?
Well, I think most of us thought we were going to go back to our lives that we'd left behind before. I was definitely going to be a butcher. I was going to go back to butchering. Tom Tony was going to be a bricky, back to bricklaying. Dickie Dunn was talking he would still be back in the police force. Phil Garber was going to carry on being a mortar mechanic. I don't know what Ralph was supposed to be doing, but he was going back to the war. And he was just going to... I think we all thought was carry on from more or less where we left off. You know, we're going to get married, some of us, and some weren't going to get married. And
What did people say that they might do differently now that, you know, once you were going through this experience? What would you do differently when you got back that maybe you hadn't done before?
We'd never join a bloody association of any sort. We weren't going to be regimented anymore. We were going to be individuals. And we really talked about... Nobody had any real plans of what... Only that, as I said, I was going to be a butcher. Tony was going to be... He was going back to Britain. Phil Carrick was going back to work for the co-op because Phil Carrick was getting paid by the co-op while he was a POW. He was getting about seven bob a week. For all the time he was in the POW. Well, for all the time he was in the forces, he was going back to work for the co-op. He worked in the... he didn't work in the co-op in the shop, he worked in the warehouse for the co-op. And he was getting a sort of a wage, in a way, as some of the men who worked in Soontop Steelworks, they got so much put aside from every week.
Now, you'd been here for quite a long time now. You got to know each other. All of you had come up from Italy, is that correct? You'd all come through the Italian camps.
Yeah, we'd all come from the Italian camps.
Now, and can you remember where the men had been captured? Were you all from North Africa, or were some from the desert?
No, some were from the desert. Johnny Eiley, Akers, and I believe Jock had come from the desert side of the campaign. Most of those had come from North Africa. Had been captured in North Africa. Dunny was captured. Where was Dunny captured? Dunster could have been on the African side, on the desert side of the unit.
Did any stories stick in your mind that your fellow POWs told you about there?
No, not really, because our most conversation when we were first captured was food. And later on when we got we did get talking to each other. But later on when we were getting food and we got the cards and we got the bit of music and that sort of thing, we sort of never talked about the army. Not to any great extent.
Were any of your did any of you receive parcels or anything from the various regimental prisoner of war funds? Because a lot of regiments had funds for the prisoners of war. You know, they would send cigarettes and comforts and things. Did anybody?
I received a parcel after the war in England. We received two anyway.
What were they?
Food parcels.
After the war?
After the war. When we were when we first came home from POW camp, before going back into the army, we were home for about 13 weeks. And there was food parcels from regimental associations. But they weren't for any particular, they weren't, some was from the Lincolns. The whole pass was made up, but was paid for by these regimental associations. And we got two. Didn't you ever get any?
Oh, I don't know. But what
it
did
was
you
just extra food.
But you didn't get them till you were back in England?
No, but because they were bought in England. There was, these two came and they the first lot were distributed at Scunthorpe Church Hall, and the bloke who organised it was called Jack Lloyd. He was an ex-POW. And then we got another parcel shortly afterwards.
Right.
That was after the war was over and we were at home in England.
Now, while you were still in Germany, were you expecting parcels from the regimental funds, or
no,
was it just not something
that... No, nobody ever thought about them, did they? A lot of these things we didn't know about. I mean, they didn't tell you before you was, if you get captured, the regiment will see you all right. I mean, anything like that was just a complete surprise.
Now, so as you moved into 1945, did you notice a gradual decline in the state of...
Oh, definitely.
In what ways? How did the German situation show?
The German people were getting worried about what was going to happen to them. And the biggest fear they had was the Russians and the Black Americans. They really were terrified that they would be... Well, I think they thought they were going to suffer the same way as they'd made some other people suffer. Not what they'd made of it, but what the Germans had made other people suffer. And there was a lot more news. I mean, Mrs. Price's family lived in Halle, and they came to stop with her in Smedenberg because of the bombing in Halle and Leipzig. So there was a lot more fear, apprehension of how the war was going to end for them, and what they were going to get out of it, or if they were going to get out of it.
Now, the Allies were apparently dropping lots of propaganda leaflets over Germany.
Yeah.
Did you?
They also dropped that bloody black and white stuff as well.
The radar foil.
Yeah.
Now, these leaflets
were printed in German.
Now, did any of the Germans you know read these things?
Yeah, most of them.
And how did they read them? Did they read them in a... Were they careful of...
The first thing that when them leaflets was dropped, all the men who worked for the staff, that included Johnny Ireland and myself, were to go clean them up. But obviously you couldn't clean them all up, it was impossible. I mean, some fell into backyard, some fell in the waste ground, and was in the all them what was in the main streets and we had to clean up. And they were just dumped. But obviously there was some. But old Norman, he was in charge of us sweeping them up, so obviously he read them. And the other two men who worked on the stat was out with us, so obviously they read them. They weren't supposed to read them, but obviously they did.
What about people like Mrs. Price?
She read them.
And did you read them, the prisoners, did you?
Well, we couldn't read them, couldn't we? Not.
Did you not try to?
Well, we had no idea what it was saying, telling the war for Germans. Germany was kaput. But it was... And the German population is in that... I mean, it wasn't such a big village. It's a smallish town, very... And they were just... It was getting to that point where they knew that the war was over for them and they were on the wrong side.
Now, you had your photograph taken as a group at this around about this time, didn't
yep.
you? Could you talk about how that happened?
Well, I think it was Benny Lewis's idea in the first place. We ought to have a photograph of us all together. But this happened before that time. because Bill Wool is still on that photograph. This happened before the four men was taken to Silesia.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about the four men being sent.
We're getting a bit. It's remembering in what order things happened.
So when do you think the photograph was taken?
Well, must have had obviously the photograph was taken before the four men was taken to Silesia.
And that was, but was it both? They were both after Christmas, these events.
Oh yeah, it was after Christmas. It was towards the end of the war.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the photograph, and then we'll talk about the four men that were transferred. So
it was either Ben Lewis or Del Mabry, and Dickie Dunn's on that photograph. So it was before he was taken to hospital, which again was nearly at the end of the war. I think it was Ben Lewis who instigated it in the first place, and he asked me to ask Mrs. Price if she could take a postcard for us. But it all had to be done through the postman and through the burgomaster. We had to have the burgomaster's permission for Mrs. Price to bring the camel up to the library. And then we got two photographs. One was a group sitting down, ranged on benches. The benches were out of the library. And the photograph was actually taken in front of the library. And then the other one was just marching away from... We were going to play football actually that day. And it was a Sunday afternoon. And the postman... I think the postman took that photo, but he used Mrs. Price's camera. And he got us in sort of movement, you know.
What about the group photograph? The guard's not on that one.
No, the guard's not on any of them, is he?
Did he... Was that a choice of his not to be on them?
Yeah, I think it was, actually. He never... Well, we just arranged ourselves in a group and Mrs. Price took the photograph. And, as I say, it must have been before the men went to Starlight, and it must have been before Dickie Dunn was taken bad with scarlet fever.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned off the tip that four of the men were transferred somewhere else. Could you just go through your memory of how that happened and how it was?
When the postman came, he said, we're taking four men. Four men are being sent somewhere else. To the coal mines, it was. And
this was early 45, you think?
Early 45. So, he wanted two from the Stat and two from the Brickworks. Rolf, Garbutt, and then we never considered for it. So when it comes to picking him out, to pick me to go, Bill Woolley, Jim Britton and Sainsley. And when the postman told Mrs. Price that I was going, she said, well, she obviously used her influence to keep me behind. So I can't remember what in my place. But there was a little bit of... See, I was mucky with Bill Woolley. That's why they was going to send me out. I think he was sent in my place. They weren't very happy about that to me, so it was fair, it was. I mean, and I was really pleased it was.
So, the form, you didn't have any choice at all, really?
Not really. I was lucky that Mrs. Price intervened and I didn't have to go. See.
And did these men know where they were going to?
Well, they didn't know where they was going, but they knew it was a coal mine.
And you assumed it would be worse conditions than what you had?
It certainly wouldn't be worse for me, wouldn't it?
So, can you remember the last night with as a group of 24 before?
We didn't get a last night. It took about nearly straight away. You know, they came one day and said they wanted four men.
Who was it that came then? Who were the they? Who was that?
The postman. Everything came through the postman. His sergeant major came with his orders that four men from Smedeberg. And the next day there was on the way. And I say it caused a bit of bad taste with some of them, and I mean, but then if they could have gone off, if Bill Woolley could have gone out of it, he wouldn't have.
And who were the others that went? Woolley.
Britain. And I think the other one was Davis. Davis. The one with the. Jim Britton and Davis weren't fit workers. You know what I mean? They weren't fit people, fit men. So the brickworks got shut of them. Obviously, the brickworks must have had to pay for this foreign labour. I don't know how they paid, but must have paid somewhere. So there was Jim Britton and Davis.
And didn't you mention Washington as well?
Washington didn't go, did he? I can't be sure.
Anyway, so four of you.
I know Woolley went, because after he went, I mucked in with Phil Kelly, who was. Yes, Joe Washington could have been the other one, because he mucked in with Phil Kelly, because they both came from a similar area around Manchester. Yeah, it could have been Joe.
Mm. So, well, anyway, four of you left, so there were only 20.
Back to 20 then. Mm.
And then you mentioned Dunster becoming ill. Can you describe that?
Oh, yes.
The process of that?
Dickie was badly without the edit, so he stopped in bed. And when we came back at night, he was sweating, and because he'd been left in the lager on his own. Nobody stayed with him, because we all had to go to work just the same. And when the lads come back from the brickyard at night, Dickie was sweating, he was covered with a rash. So the postman said, well, I'll let him go to the hospital. But the hospital's in Wittenberg. So I was going down to the station. We had to carry him on a stretcher all the way from the camp down to the station, and it seemed to be a hell of a long way.
And who were they?
Six of us went to carry him. Georgie Gent and me, Phil Carrick, Benny Lewis. And there were six of us carrying him. You'd carry him so far, and then two more would take over, and then you'd. And that's how I was going to the railway station. And we never saw him anymore. But after I'd been out, just after I got married, guess what I went down with? Scarlet fever. So whether I'd contacted Dr. Dickie and it had laid dormant, but he was in a bad way when we took him down to the station, and we took him away. But I found out Dickie was all right when I went to visit Mrs. Price after the war. Mm-hmm. Dickie Dunster had already been.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. So there's only 19 of you now.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned off the tape an encounter with the Hitler Youth. Could you describe that?
We decided that after Dickie Dunster, and it must have been quite towards the end of the war, because it was only after Dickie Dunster had been badly with scarlet fever that the Foston come and said, well, we'd best change all our bedding. So all that we took, the only bedding we really changed was the palliasses. The palliasses was, all the straw was taken out of the palliasses and thrown in the field at the back and burnt. And me and Phil Carrick, along with the Coleman on his horse and cart, was going to a farm to refill the palliasses. Of which there was about 19, 20 of them. And while we were going along this road towards this farm, there for the air stacks, we met the Hitler Youth, and we were marching single file, so many at one side of the road, and so many at the other end. There was one on this road. And me and Phil Carrick started laughing at them. We knew the war was over. Just a matter of time now. And we started jeering at them. Germany kaput, Deutschland. And one of the leading lads in one of these sections, he brought his rifle up. If he intervened in the section where the officer in charge was, he would have really shot us. He was absolutely knackered. Come from the German company, they was absolutely shattered. And there was only kids 16 years of age.
So they'd been frontline.
They'd been frontline somewhere. And they really were absolutely assholes.
So what kind of...
They always wore a brown uniform. They weren't in battle dress same as the German army. They was in brown uniform.
And were they heavily armed still?
They all had rifles.
And what was their morale, do you think, at this stage?
Shattered, absolutely flattered. You see, and most of them, I don't suppose anyone was from that part of Germany, Saxony, and they could have been from all over Germany for all we know. But we, I think that was the most frightening moment we had all the time we was in Germany. We thought, bloody hell, we got to this end and we're going to get... That just flashed through your mind, you know, when he brought that rifle. Because I know he was a shot one of us.
What did you think about your own behaviour after that?
Well, we were being pretty stupid. You know, there was that jubilant that was, we could see the end of the war, we could see ourselves going home.
And their officer, how did he?
He just shouted at him.
And then what did you?
And Bolton, and that.
What was your reaction then?
Oh, I think it was relief. We really were frightened. I mean, it would only show one of us, I know, but it could have been me and it could have been either one. It might have been missed anyway, but the fact that we got that close to somebody firing at us at that range, because we were on a horse and cart, and that was on that side of the road, and there was on both sides of the road, and we'd driven through them, and it just...
And you were jeering as you went through them.
Yeah.
And I think again you mentioned off the tape that the aftermath of that the next day with the air raid. Can you describe that?
This German youth, there's quite a lot of them. I think there'll be 40 or 50 in this group, and they camped not far from in the wooded area and outside of Smedeberg, next day they suffered an air raid, a really strapping and attempts.
Could you describe that, how that took place?
Well, we didn't see them. We just heard about it from the Germans in the village later on in the day. We heard the bombing and we heard the strapping, we heard the aeroplanes. And we saw one, it wouldn't be a Spitfire, I don't think. Could have been a Spitfire, but it was that bloody quick, weren't they? It had rounds, wasn't it? That's what was the main thing. It had the round RAF things on it. And there was quite a few of them that was injured. But there was only kids.
So they were attacked in the camp?
Yeah, the camp was attacked. I mean, nobody would know what was in them tents, but it was obviously military tents where they were, and they got strapped.
And was this part of a general air raid that was happening?
No, they didn't evacuate the village.
What was the attitude of the villagers to you after this then? Did that change?
No, it didn't change. The German villagers, the people of the village were frightened. They knew the war was over and they were frightened. And it was just a matter of time.
Do you have any memories of the plane that the American bomber flying over?
It must have crashed not far away because it only just cleared the village and it was on fire. There was smoke coming out of it, and it was where it was going. Well, it must have landed somewhere in the vicinity. I mean, aircraft it could travel 20 miles in no time, couldn't it, even when it was coming down? So it must have crashed somewhere in the vicinity. But we never heard anything that know about it.
And that was the nearest that you came to?
Yeah.
So, did your routine continue?
Mine did, yeah.
Until when?
Well, all of them did. Until the crossing come.
And we'll get to the actual final day with the guard and so on, but during this routine, did anything stop, and what stayed the same, and what stopped over this period?
Well, we went to work the same, but I don't think we worked the same. The work in the brickyard, they didn't make as many bricks, and nobody, you know, the Germans were was crying to him to try and enforce it, and we, well, we defended it as well. I mean, the bathhouse still worked. They worked because there were still soldiers coming across, and there was the civilians and there was the old people. But things just relaxed. It was, the Germans were just going fine.
Did you still get your daily ration every day? That was,
yeah, just the same.
And what about the Red Cross parcels?
Well, we got more because we had to go cleaning. We got some extra Red Cross parcels because there was, we cleaned out all the parcels that were left from the store. Mm.
But you were still under the guard's discipline?
Yes, we were still in charge.
So, you described her earlier how several of you had access to the radio, so you knew the general situation, yeah, as the Russians and the Americans were closing in.
We were frightened the Russians would get to us first.
You were frightened as well?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, we didn't look on the Russians as allies, and we did on the Americans. We knew Americans, didn't we? We'd been in the army with Americans, but we hadn't been in the army with the Russians.
And what about the Russian POWs in the village? Do you have any thoughts with them about?
Yeah, well, they, one or two of them, they didn't leave until we did. But they knew things was going their way.
Did anybody think about maybe striking out on your own at first? You know,
didn't think about. Well, nobody ever tried it, did they? So obviously we didn't. We hadn't thought about it. We thought somebody would leave the village, and we were frightened it could be the Russians rather than the. And actually, it was the Russians, wasn't it?
Now we'll get to that. But so you're in the hut. The war's closing in.
We could hear guns firing. Both sides of us.
And when did
you could see? Now we'd go stand in the front, and you could see the flashes. You know, there was some distance away, man, but I mean, you could still see them.
What was the reaction of the Germans the first day and the first night that you could hear the gunfire?
The Germans have given up. The villagers have given up, and they're worried about what is going to happen to them. They've come to a what's going to happen to me position.
And
we also, at that time, we had what them bastards Germans called? What did we call the secret police?
The Gestapo.
The Gestapo. We had a Gestapo agent move into the village, and he took over. He took the Burgermeister over. He took over. Whether it was to enforce things or what, I don't know. That's the only time we had a Gestapo in the village.
Can you describe this man?
Yes, he was. Well, I would say he would have been a soldier at one time. He was very young and dressed mostly in dark clothing. He had no weapon to be seen. All he had on his sleeve was a big armband with a Nazi signal and the swastika on it.
And what did he do? What did he?
Well, I don't know what he did, but he certainly took over the Burgermeister house, and he went into the rats cellar. Because the Reichskeller was the Reichskeller really is the council chamber. Where was the Reichskeller restaurant, but we just called it the Reichskeller. And the policeman, he took over the police. There was only one policeman in the village. He was in there as well. But he only came a few days before the end of the year. Well, it was disappearing.